November 30th, 1939. Finnish Soviet border. 4:47 a.m. A 19-year-old Finnish soldier named Taisto Mäkinen crouches in a snow-filled ditch. Temperature, minus 31 degrees Celsius. He can't feel his fingers anymore. His rifle is frozen to his gloves. Through the darkness, he hears it. Metal grinding against ice. Engines rumbling. The ground vibrating beneath his boots. Soviet T-26 light tanks, dozens of them, rolling toward his position in a column that stretches back into the forest like a steel snake. Taisto has 6 rounds of ammunition. His unit has 1 anti-tank rifle for an entire company. The Soviets have sent 450,000 soldiers, 6,000 armored vehicles, and 3,800 aircraft to conquer Finland. The Finnish army has 340,000 men, 32 tanks, and almost nothing that can stop Soviet armor. The world expects Finland to fall in 2 weeks, but Taisto isn't holding a rifle anymore. He's holding something else, a glass bottle filled with a sticky brown liquid. A rag soaked in tar hangs from the neck. His sergeant whispers,
"Wait for the lead tank. Hit the engine compartment."
The first T-26 rumbles past their position. 20 meters, 15, 10. Taisto stands, lights the rag, throws. The bottle shatters against the tank's rear deck. Fire spreads across the engine compartment like liquid sunrise. Flames pour through ventilation slits. The tank lurches, stops. Black smoke billows from every opening. The hatch opens. Soviet crewmen scramble out. 2 more bottles fly from the ditch. 2 more tanks burning. The column halts. Panic spreads. In the narrow forest road, the remaining tanks can't turn around. They're trapped in a corridor of fire. By dawn, 14 Soviet tanks lie destroyed. The Finnish company hasn't lost a single man. 1 week later, Finnish soldiers have a name for their homemade weapon. They call it Molotovin cocktail, a cocktail for Comrade Molotov. But here's what nobody knows yet. This bottle wasn't improvised at all. It was engineered by a Finnish captain who spent 2 years turning a crude idea into a precision weapon. Who designed the weapon that changed warfare forever? Moscow, 1938, 1 year before the war. Joseph Stalin spreads a map across his desk. His finger traces the Finnish border, only 32 kilometers from Leningrad, the Soviet Union's second city. Finland is a problem. Not because Finland threatens the USSR. Finland has 3.7 million people. The Soviet Union has 170 million. Finland's entire military budget equals what the Red Army spends in a week. Finland is a problem because it exists in the wrong place. If Germany attacks the Soviet Union, and Stalin knows it's coming eventually, they could use Finland as a launching pad. German troops could reach Leningrad in hours. The city that bears Lenin's name could fall before Moscow even mobilizes. Stalin wants a buffer. He wants Finland's border pushed back. He wants military bases on Finnish territory. He wants guarantees that Finland will never ally with Germany. The Finns refuse everything. They've been independent for only 20 years. They fought a brutal civil war to escape Russian control. They will not become a Soviet puppet state. Stalin doesn't understand. Small countries don't say no to superpowers. Small countries accept their fate. If Finland won't give him what he wants peacefully, he'll take it by force. The Red Army begins planning Operation... There is no operation name. Soviet commanders are so confident that they don't bother with code names. They call it simply the Finnish Campaign. Expected duration, 12 days. Expected casualties, minimal. Expected resistance, negligible. They have no idea what's waiting for them in the forest. And they've never heard of Captain Eero Kuitinen. What happens when an army of 450,000 meets an engineer with a chemistry set? Kouvola, Finland, 1937, 2 years before the war. Captain Eero Kuitinen sits in a cramped office at the Koria military garrison. On his desk, intelligence reports from Spain, photographs of burned-out tanks, testimonies from observers watching the Spanish Civil War unfold. Kuitinen is 34 years old, an engineer by training, a soldier by necessity. His job is unglamorous. logistics, and field equipment for the Finnish Defense Forces. The intelligence from Spain is clear. In the streets of Madrid, Republican soldiers are stopping nationalist tanks with nothing but glass bottles filled with gasoline. They call them bombas de gasolina. Crude. Desperate. Sometimes effective. Quittenden reads the reports three times. Then, he does something no other military officer in Europe is doing. He decides to make it better. Not just a bottle with fuel, a proper military tool with consistent performance, reliable ignition, and maximum lethality against armor. He requisitions supplies, sets up a testing range, begins experiments that will consume 2 years of his life. First problem, the fuel mixture. Pure gasoline burns hot, but flows off metal surfaces like water. When a bottle breaks against tank armor, most of the fuel slides away before it can do damage. Quittenden adds tar. The sticky black substance makes the mixture cling to surfaces. Now, when the bottle shatters, the burning fuel adheres to armor. But tar alone isn't enough. He experiments with ratios. More tar means better adhesion, but slower burning. Less tar means faster flames, but shorter duration. He settles on a formula, one part tar to three parts gasoline, then adds wood alcohol. The mixture burns hotter, produces more smoke, creates a choking cloud that forces tank crews to evacuate. The fuel is ready. Korea Testing Range, winter 1938. Kuitinen watches another failed test. A soldier lights a rag tied to a bottleneck. The flame illuminates his position like a beacon. Any enemy within 500 meters can see exactly where he's standing. He throws. The wind catches the rag. The flame dies. The bottle shatters uselessly against the target tank, spilling unlit fuel across the snow. The Spanish method doesn't work. A burning rag reveals the thrower. Wind extinguishes the flame. Rain makes ignition impossible. Kuitinen needs something better. He experiments with storm matches, long wooden matches designed to burn in harsh conditions. He develops a system where two storm matches are taped to the bottle sides. Strike the matches, throw immediately. The bottle burns only after it shatters. Better. The thrower has less exposure time. But storm matches can still blow out. There's still a brief moment of visibility. Then, Kuitinen discovers phosphorus. White phosphorus ignites on contact with air. Seal it in a small glass ampule. Attach the ampule to the bottle with rubber bands. When the bottle breaks, the ampule breaks too. Phosphorus meets air. Automatic ignition. The thrower can launch from complete darkness. No flame, no warning. Just the sound of shattering glass, then fire. By summer 1939, Kuitinen's polttopullo, Finnish for burning bottle, is ready for mass production. He's created a weapon that costs almost nothing, can be manufactured anywhere, and can stop a 10-ton tank. And Finland has no military factories to spare. Moscow, November 26, 1939. Vyacheslav Molotov steps to a microphone in the Kremlin, Soviet foreign minister, Stalin's right hand. His announcement shocks the world. Finnish artillery has shelled the Soviet village of Manila, killing four Red Army soldiers. The Soviet Union demands Finland withdraw its forces and apologize for aggression. There's one problem. The shelling never happened. Finnish observation post recorded no artillery fire. Soviet troops weren't even stationed in Manila. The entire incident is NKVD fabrication, a pretext manufactured to justify invasion. Finland refuses to apologize for an attack it didn't commit. 4 days later, 450,000 Soviet soldiers pour across the border. Bombers hit Helsinki. Artillery pounds fortifications. Tank columns advance through forests. And Molotov delivers another radio address.
Soviet aircraft are not dropping bombs on Finnish cities. They are delivering bread to the starving Finnish people.
The bombs keep falling. Finnish civilians keep dying. And Finnish soldiers start calling the Soviet incendiary bombs Molotov's breadbaskets. If those are his breadbaskets, they say, then here is a drink to go with them. Molotovan cocktail. A cocktail for Comrade Molotov. The name sticks. Within weeks, it spreads from Finnish trenches to international newspapers. The irony is perfect, naming the weapon after the man whose lies made it necessary. But names mean nothing without production. Finland needs bottles. Hundreds of thousands of them. Helsinki, December 1939. Finland has one industry with unlimited bottle production capacity. One industry with mixing facilities and nationwide distribution. One industry that suddenly has nothing else to do. The alcohol industry. Finland's state liquor monopoly, Alko, operates distilleries and bottling plants across the country. With war, alcohol production halts. Workers sit idle. Equipment gathers dust. Within 48 hours, Alko factories pivot to weapons production. The Helsinki facility leads. Workers who bottled vodka last week now fill bottles with Kuitinen's tar gasoline mixture. Quality control teams that checked alcohol content now verify fuel ratios. Distribution networks that delivered liquor to stores now ship incendiary weapons to trenches. Production numbers are staggering. First month, 40,000 Molotov cocktails. January 1940, 80,000. February, 120,000. Total wartime production, over 450,000 bottles. Each bottle comes with instructions printed on the label. Strike storm matches before throwing. Aim for engine compartment or turret joints. Throw from cover at distances under 25 meters. Follow up with second bottle if fire doesn't spread. The Soviets have 6,000 armored vehicles. Finland has 500,000 bottles. And in the forest of Karelia, Finnish soldiers are about to prove that bottles can kill tanks. But first, they need to survive the opening disaster. Karelian Isthmus, December 1st, 1939. The Soviet offensive hits like a hammer. 7 rifle divisions cross the border simultaneously. 200,000 men pushing toward the Mannerheim Line, Finland's main defensive position. Artillery barrages shake the frozen ground for hours before each assault. Finnish defenders are outnumbered 4-1. In some sectors, 10-1. The first week is catastrophic. Soviet tanks punch through forward positions almost unopposed. Finnish anti-tank guns are too few and too scattered to create effective barriers. Infantry retreats through the snow, leaving equipment behind. At Taipale, the Soviets throw 4,000 men against Finnish positions in a single morning. Bodies stack 3 deep in front of machine gun nests. The attacks keep coming. At Suma, Soviet armor breaks through the line completely. For 6 terrifying hours, there's nothing between the tanks and the road to Helsinki. Finnish commanders scramble reserves from every sector. Cooks, clerks, and supply drivers grab rifles and move to plug gaps. The line holds. Barely. By December 10th, the Soviets have advanced 25 kilometers. Finnish casualties? 8,000 men. The army is bleeding out. But something strange is happening in the forests. Soviet columns are vanishing. A battalion enters the woods pursuing retreating Finns. Radio contact stops. Scouts find burned vehicles, frozen bodies. No survivors. Finnish ski troops are hunting, and they're carrying bottles. Finnish forest, December 1939, minus 40 degrees. Lieutenant Arna Utilainen leads a ski patrol of 12 men through darkness. They've been moving for 6 hours. No fires, no hot food. Survival means staying invisible. Utilainen is 35 years old. Before the war, he hunted elk in these forests. Now, he hunts tanks. His patrol carries rifles, knives, and canvas bags stuffed with Molotov cocktails. Each man has 4 bottles, 48 bottles total. They find the Soviet column at dawn, a supply convoy, trucks loaded with ammunition and fuel, escorted by 3 T-26 tanks. The vehicles are stopped on a narrow forest road, engines idling, crews eating breakfast. Soviet doctrine says tanks are invincible. Soviet training says infantry protects tanks from threats. Soviet commanders say Finnish resistance is collapsing. Soviet commanders are wrong. Utilainen signals his men. They spread through the trees on both sides of the road. 200 meters of kill zone. The first bottle hits the lead tank's engine compartment. Fire blooms. The second bottle hits the rear tank. Now the convoy is trapped, burning vehicles blocking both ends of the road. 12 Finns with bottles against 200 Soviets with tanks. The Soviets panic. Tank crews can't see through smoke and flames. Infantry scrambles for cover, but there's no cover on a forest road. Machine gun fire tears through the trees, but Finnish soldiers are already moving, already throwing, already gone. 40 minutes later, Utilainen counts the damage. 3 tanks destroyed, 11 trucks burning. Soviet dead, approximately 60. Finnish casualties, 1 man wounded in the arm. The patrol skis away before Soviet reinforcements arrive. This scene repeats across the front. Small Finnish units hitting Soviet columns, destroying vehicles, disappearing into forest the Soviets can't navigate. The Red Army has more tanks than Finland has soldiers. But in the forest, tanks are coffins. And the biggest coffin is waiting on a road called Rate. Rate Road. January 1st, 1940. Colonel Hjalmar Silasvuo stares at a map that should terrify him. His 9th Division, 11,500 men, faces 2 Soviet divisions, 48,000 enemy soldiers, 4 times his strength. The Soviets are advancing along Rate Road, a narrow track through 50 kilometers of wilderness. Their objective? Cut Finland in half. Silasvuo should retreat. Every military textbook says retreat. Instead, he attacks. Rate Road is a single track through dense forest. The Soviets must advance nose to tail. They can't spread out. They can't maneuver. If Silasvuo blocks the road at multiple points, the entire column becomes trapped. Cut the snake into pieces. Kill each piece separately. January 5th. Finnish ski troops move into position. The attack begins at dawn. White camouflaged soldiers emerge from the forest at 5 points simultaneously. Roadblocks of felled trees trap Soviet vehicles. Molotov cocktails arc through the cold air. The lead tanks burn first, then the rear guard. The middle of the column, 10 kilometers of trapped vehicles, has nowhere to go. Private Urho Karjalainen runs toward a stationary T-28 tank. 20 meters. 15. 10. He throws. The bottle shatters. Fire blooms. The tank's fuel tank catches. Secondary explosion. A Soviet crewman climbs out, uniform burning, takes 3 steps, collapses. Karjalainen vomits in the snow, then picks up another bottle. For 7 days, the Finns attack and disappear. Attack and disappear. Soviet soldiers freeze in the open. Soviet tanks run out of fuel. Soviet commanders lose contact with their units. The 163rd Division dies first, then the 44th. When the battle ends, 27,000 Soviet dead. Finnish casualties, 900. The Finns capture 43 tanks, 71 field guns, 260 trucks, equipment worth more than Finland's annual military budget, and bottles. Simple glass bottles destroyed more tanks than Finnish artillery. But Stalin has unlimited men and unlimited tanks. The question isn't whether Finland can win. The question is how long Finland can survive. Mannerheim Line, February 1940. Stalin is humiliated. The Winter War was supposed to last 2 weeks. Instead, the Red Army has suffered 150,000 casualties. International newspapers mock Soviet incompetence. Hitler watches from Berlin, reassessing everything he thought he knew about Soviet military power. Stalin responds the only way he knows, more of everything. 600,000 soldiers mass on the Karelian Isthmus, 3,000 tanks, artillery concentrations that dwarf anything seen in World War I. February 11th, the final offensive begins. The bombardment lasts 12 hours. Finnish positions receive more shells in one morning than the entire war so far. Bunkers collapse. Communication lines vaporize. Soldiers go deaf from the noise. Then the tanks come. This time, Soviet tactics are different. Infantry advances ahead of armor, clearing anti-tank teams. coordinated airstrikes hit Finnish reserves. No more sending tanks alone into forest. The Soviets have learned. Corporal Simo Mäkelä defends a bunker at Suma. His team has 43 Molotov cocktails. In 3 days, they destroy 7 tanks. Each kill requires running within 25 meters of an enemy vehicle under machine gun fire. 2 of his team die making throws. By day 4, they're out of bottles. They improvise, find bottles in a ruined farmhouse, mix gasoline with motor oil from a wrecked truck. The improvised weapons burn poorly. They use them anyway. It's not enough. February 15th. Soviet tanks breach the Mannerheim line. Finnish units begin retreating to secondary positions. The retreat is orderly, professional, heartbreaking. March 5, 1940. Soviet forces reach Viipuri, Finland's second largest city. Finnish defenses are collapsing. Ammunition is running out. Men are falling asleep in trenches. The Finnish government faces extermination. They've inflicted 321,000 casualties on the Soviet Union. 5 Soviets dead for every Finn. They've proven that small nations can resist superpowers. They've invented tactics military academies will study for generations, but they cannot win. March 12, 1940. The Moscow Peace Treaty. Finland cedes 11% of its territory. 400,000 Finns evacuate their homes. The Karelian Isthmus, including Viipuri, becomes Soviet. But Finland remains independent. The Soviet plan to occupy the entire country has failed. The puppet government Stalin prepared never takes power. Stalin gets territory. Finland keeps sovereignty. The Winter War ends. 105 days of fighting. 70,000 Finnish casualties. 321,000 Soviet casualties. And Captain Kuitinen's bottles? Finnish records show Molotov cocktails destroyed or disabled over 400 Soviet tanks during the war, more than all other anti-tank weapons combined. The Pultapulo worked exactly as designed, but the weapon's story is just beginning. Within months, resistance movements across occupied Europe start asking the same question. The Molotov cocktail outlives the war that created it. Hungary. 1956. Soviet tanks roll into Budapest. Hungarian freedom fighters throw bottles from apartment windows. The design is almost identical to Kuitinen's formula. Somehow, the specifications have spread across borders. Prague. 1968. Czechoslovak protesters face Soviet armor with gasoline and glass. Same weapon, same enemy, same defiance. Warsaw, Belfast, Ramallah, Caracas, Kyiv. Wherever the weak face the strong, the bottle appears. The name has become universal. Even Russian soldiers use it now, forgetting its ironic origin. A weapon named to mock Soviet lies, used against Soviet aggression for 80 years. Vyacheslav Molotov lived until 1986. He hated the name, called it Western propaganda, insisted Soviets never use the term. He was lying. Soviet soldiers used it constantly. The irony had become permanent. Captain Eero Kuitinen died in 1977. His obituary mentioned nothing about the Pultapulo. The man who standardized one of history's most copied weapons passed almost unnoticed. His legacy lives in archives, testing reports, production specifications, training manuals, and in every conflict where glass meets gasoline meets desperation. February 2022. Ukrainian breweries shift from beer to Molotov cocktails. The design matches Kuitinen's 1939 specifications almost exactly. Some weapons never become obsolete. The Soviets invaded Finland with 6,000 tanks. Finland answered with 500,000 bottles. The bottles didn't win the war. Finland lost territory, lost cities, lost lives. But Finland survived, independent, unoccupied, unbroken. And somewhere in a museum in Korea, a small brown bottle sits next to a Soviet T-26 tank. The tank is massive. The bottle is tiny. But the bottle won.